Hi, I'm interested in the Pomona swivel armchair you have out there on the floor. So it says the upholstery is like bantha pleather, and I was wondering if that was literal, because banthas are technically endangered. So you're not supposed to make chairs out of them? Also, I read where some chairs are made by companies owned by Tuscan Raiders. You know, so-called sand people. But I read somewhere that they don't treat their workers well. Also, do you give your droids breaks? Because even though they're machines, they're sentient. So they need recreation. Are you going to answer any of my questions? Or are you just going to stand there in your big black cloak breathing? Because I can go to Raymore and Skywalker and get my Lando Calrissian Aeron chair in True Black there. Could you at least give me 20% off because it's an unethically made chair? So that's a no. Okay, then we're gonna do a whole radio show on how to match up your consumer spending with your values. You'll be sorry. And now he refuses to eat broccoli that didn't die a natural death. Colin McEnroe.
Earlier this month, we recorded a conversation on ethical consumerism at Watkinson School. We knew that some consumers are concerned about the treatment of workers who make their cell phones and about environmental impacts of everything from mattresses to cleaning products. But concern is one thing and knowing what to do is another. We had a dream panel. The guests were Barry Nailbuff, the co-founder of Honest Tea. He's also a professor at the Yale School of Management and co-author of Mission in a Bottle, The Honest Guide to Doing Business Differently and Succeeding. We had Bun Lai, the founder and head chef at Mia Sushi in New Haven, probably the most sustainable sushi restaurant in America. We had David Bollier, an American activist, writer, and policy strategist. He's also collaborated with Norman Lear on a bunch of social projects. He's the co-editor of The Wealth of the Commons, A World Beyond Market and State. And Stephanie Winnuck, an associate for policy and programs at the Product Stewardship Institute. They're a Boston-based institute. They look at the impact of products both upstream and downstream from their point of purchase and try to work with governments and companies to figure out how to dispose of them better and how to get better raw materials, too. So I started things out with a little story about the last fish.
My friend David Jacobson sometimes says to me that someday we'll be in a restaurant and they'll bring out the last fish. You know, they'll say, here it is. It's the last one. That's all that's left. Enjoy it. Which is a frightening idea, but obviously we are. We have an overfishing problem. That's not the only problem when we go out for sushi. Everybody loves sushi. Some of you maybe went out for sushi before we went here. So, Bun, let's say they went to one of the lovely sushi restaurants in this area, and there are many nice sushi restaurants in this area. What were they eating? Where did it come from? Tell us a little bit about the standard sushi experience.
Yeah, so my mom started Mia's 31 years ago. My mother's from Kyushu, Japan. When she was growing up, she had a vast array of seafood that was fished right in her backyard. And that's the way it really was for, you know, the generation of many of our parents. But today, not just sushi, but our food system is really internationalist. So, you know, if you're talking about seafood, you're talking about 85% of the seafood that you eat is not domestic anymore. Now, when you're eating at a sushi bar, you're traveling the world. That's what you're doing. So, if you want to take a cheap vacation, just go to a sushi bar. You know, it's because that tilapia that you're eating that might be called red snapper is most likely from China, and since China has very backward, undeveloped sewage. I'm happy that we already ate, by the way. sewage treatment facilities. Often the fish are raised with water that's drawn from rivers where raw sewage from human beings and livestock like pigs and chicken are going in. And the tilapia will thrive because the tilapia will thrive on detritus instead of heavy.
And just to follow up for a second, and I want to weave in the rest of the panel as we go, but I want to give a quick example. So a couple of the kinds of decisions that you've made that I've experienced, and I don't know how much they filter out into the entire restaurant, but one of them I know. On one occasion I was there and I was eating a shore crab mm-hmm. that is an invasive species, right? Mm-hmm. So you go out and catch this shore crab or get this shore crab somehow?
We do.
Yeah.
Yes. We go out, half my staff are scuba certified. We have almost 100 acres of shellfishing grounds on the thimbles. Mia's has two boats as well. We collect wild seaweeds and many different invasive species as well, because invasive species is a top five ecological problem. And it really kind of adds to the conversation of since our food system, by and large, is so incredibly destructive, what can we do and what can we start eating so that it would help restore the health of the ecosystem instead? And that is, theoretically, to take organisms that are abundant but destructive and take them out.
And you go out in the woods and dig stuff up, too. I had sassafras or some kind of soda one time where you had dug up the roots somewhere and made your own soda.
Yeah, I think, again, my staff joins me at this, you know, and going foraging. And the reason is because we're, as a society, so incredibly disconnected to nature. And the fact that all food that we're eating once was a living thing. And when you see it and in the way that it's flourishing in the wild, then you tend to respect it more.
But, you know, Barry, one of the other questions here is scalability. You live in New Haven. You know the reputation Mia's have. You listen to the stuff that he's talking about right here. But it takes a pretty unique person to do this and a unique team to do this. How scalable is the bun lie theory of sushi? I mean, you couldn't run a sushi industry this way, or could you?
I wish we could. I hope we will. I mean, I think digging up your own sassafras is probably not so scalable. But the idea of eating invasive species, totally scalable. I mean, was kudzu or kudzu? Is that how it's pronounced?
Kudzu.
Kudzu. Right, yeah. If we could figure out sort of a way of making that tasty. Oh my God, what a solution that would be to this species which is taking over a good part of the South. So I think there's almost one thing humans seem to do better than anything else is know how to get rid of something by eating it. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if we could spread a taste for invasive species, that is two wrongs make a right, and it's fantastic.
But based on what you know about how companies operate, are they likely to operate that way? I mean, sushi now gets served everywhere, right? You can go into a supermarket and buy it, and it's everywhere. It seems unlikely that these ideas. I mean, what does it take for an idea to go from somebody like him to a bigger corporation?
I think an interesting example of this is the company Palm Wonderful. A decade ago, I don't think anybody drank pomegranate juice. Mm-hmm. And the folks who started this company said, okay, we're going to plant lots of pomegranate trees, we're going to create orchards of pomegranates, and then we're going to create people who want to drink it. Mm-hmm. And the end result is that they created this large company. So if you could figure out, take the kudzu, or figure out deer that's invasive, or I don't know what other species that you have, if you could figure out how to make a market for that, companies would say, my God, cheap ingredients. Mm-hmm. This is good.
The other thing you could do is inform people. Now, Stephanie, I found out at dinner that you don't eat fish. Yeah. So, but, you know, one of the things that I do, if I go to Whole Foods, they do have this kind of labeling system, and there's green, which is, I guess you can eat the greenless fish, although he may differ about that. And then there's yellow. I'm not quite sure what I'm supposed to do, slow down while I'm eating the fish. And red, I'm not supposed to eat the fish, but Whole Foods is selling me the red fish. I kind of don't get that either. But, you know, I mean, consumers do want information anyway. Some consumers want information about where the stuff comes from, how endangered is it, how how recyclable is it? I mean, is that part of it, is just telling people more about it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that consumers definitely have an onus put on them to try and find out some of this information. Again, you know, everyone has busy lives and can't be researching every time they before they go to the grocery store. But I think that there are certain ways that they can look at and understand what these product labeling or, you know, seals mean. And if it's the green, yellow, red that Whole Foods is using, well, then maybe it's part of their responsibility to make that clear what that means, because apparently as it is now, it's still a bit confusing. So I think one of the challenges is, though, is that there's so many of these different green seals or ways to try to say this is the most sustainable product, buy this one over this one, and sometimes it isn't that simple. So
green, yellow, red bun, does it mean anything? I mean,
yeah, you know, I think Whole Foods is doing something really good, which is that at least they're making strides towards being more ethical about the type of fish that they're serving. So, you know, I guess it's easy to say, well, why do you guys have red? You know that it's bad, it's naughty. But at least they're educating people, and they're taking a step forward, I think.
Yeah. Don't buy this for $26.99 a pound. Stephanie, I want you to really put your product stewardship hat on here. We're going to switch away from fish. Let's say I'm about to buy a new cell phone. I have a feeling, but we'll get to this with the other guests too, I have a feeling I can't buy one made by workers who are, by my standards anyway, treated decently. But we'll come back to that. Are there stewardship aspects that you would like me to think about when I'm buying my cell phone?
Sure. So I think one of the major components of that decision that the Product Stewardship Institute looks at is what is going to happen with that cell phone once you're done using it. You know, these companies now are saying, encouraging people to upgrade even sooner than every 2 years, for example, with the cell phones. And I think actually cell phones is an interesting example because it actually has, I think that a lot of the cell phone carriers and retailers have recognized that there is value in those cell phones. And a lot of times people who are upgrading, you know, their cell phone still works or, you know, functions that can be repaired, something like that. And so there are these voluntary programs a lot of times. You know, you can bring your cell phone back to Verizon and they'll happily take it from you for free. There are also some programs where you can even get some money, I think, back for some of these working cell phones. So cell phones is an example, I think, of a product that kind of has this built-in loop that there's a value a lot of times, at least if the cell phone isn't working, you know, the materials, the metals in them are still valuable. And I think that the companies who make these products have caught on to that and are capturing as much back as they can.
Did that happen all by itself? Did it take organizations like yours to get them interested in it? Does it take regulation by states, which David thinks aren't going to work probably anyway? What made that happen?
So I think for cell phones in particular, that it was more of a voluntary thing that happened on its own. A similar example, though, electronics, which is a broader category that has, you know, TVs, computers, tablets, that category as a whole has not had the same kind of trajectory that cell phones had. And so the Product Stewardship Institute and others have encouraged companies, you know, Dell, HP, the makers of some of these electronics, to set up these recycling programs, especially for products that aren't working anymore. And so actually there are what we call extended producer responsibility laws. There are 25 of them across the country for electronics in different states, and Connecticut is one of those 25. So consumers can now get rid of, you know, your big screen TVs or whatnot free of charge, and that's not something that the municipalities, your local towns, are paying for, and it's part of kind of your taxes. So that's being incorporated by the product manufacturers.
Barry, meanwhile, you know, I said at the outset of this question, I probably can't buy a cell phone that's made in a place where the workers are treated the way I want workers to be treated. You know, a lot of us feel outrage if we hear about workers at these Foxconn factories. Is that outrage well-placed? Some people would argue that the only step for these workers would be a worse job in China than what Foxconn gives them. I've even seen one study that said the suicide rate for Foxconn workers is lower than China's national average. even though it seems to me that they have like a pretty hard life. But all these things are kind of relative to any kind of labor environment. I mean, I don't know. How would you encourage somebody to think about that question?
It's one of the things we do at Honest Tea is we go directly to the farmers who are growing our tea, mm-hmm. and we form a relationship with them. Mm-hmm. You can go through various organizations, whether it be Fair Trade or other groups who are doing inspections, and the challenges are that each time you go through another layer, you have less control, less influence, and there's additional markup. Mm-hmm. And it's remarkable how little extra one would have to pay to improve the lives of the workers directly. And that's not just in terms of how much you might pay for tea, but providing computers for a learning center for the tea pluckers' kids so they have access to the world. And it seems to me that if you're able to explain on your product, on your packaging, the conditions under which it's made, that can be a competitive advantage for you. That we have cause marketing that works, and that it seems to me if you can make a credible statement about the way in which your product is made more ethically, I don't think that we expect people in India to be earning minimum wage in the United States, but at the same time, we don't want them locked in factories without emergency exits. And so it doesn't take much, I think, to create standards that we would find acceptable.
You're saying you think probably people would pay an extra $25, $50, some people anyway, for a cell phone that had as part of its packaging and marketing.
The good news is it's not $25. It's probably 2.5 cents. Hmm. So that's the...
Per cell phone.
It's an incredibly small number.
Why don't companies do it?
Well, they do. Some of them are to some extent. And that's a little bit of when you see, at least in the food world, the fair trade, the organic, are things where it does cost more. Mm. But not, fortunately, not that much more.
David, why aren't companies doing that? I mean, why can't I go buy a cell phone right now where I have some assurance? Why wouldn't they have an incentive to do exactly what he's talking about?
Well, I would imagine 2.5 cents times 5 million units or even more adds up to a lot of money. And for a public company to leave that money on the table is not fiduciarily responsible, quote. You know, and so I think that a lot of just raw market factors are pushing this. And I think part of our historic challenge over the past generation has been to find effective ways to intervene in some of these, quote, natural tendencies to either cut corners, to be too efficient in ways that become socially or ecologically unacceptable. But we've seen how the regulatory process has often been captured or controlled by experts and lawyers that ordinary citizens can't affect. And we've seen how the political process itself has become somewhat compromised. Today's a red letter day in that I think we have problems for relying necessarily on regulation when we find 20 years later that, oops, those cancer studies used the wrong tolerance level, it's really this level. That I'm in favor of trying to take more direct control as possible without in any way diminishing some of these, I think, really important efforts to be more informed as a consumer, because I think those are important.
So how do you take direct control in this situation? We all want to have cell phones.
Well, for example, there's the open source equivalent of a lot of cell phones is Ubuntu. Some of you may have heard of the operating system. They're developing a mobile platform of open source software, and there's a whole open source design and manufacturing movement going on to build essentially cheap, modular, locally sourced components of things. So one could imagine devising through a global community of open source programmers with local manufacturing, we've heard of 3D manufacturing, one can imagine these apparatuses emerging to devise a more socially responsible and arguably cheaper cell phone.
You know, Bun, as you look at the world that we live in, you know, Stephanie said that increasingly cell phone companies are encouraging you not to wait 2 years. You know, get rid of your cell phone. There's some of them, I think you get a new cell phone every 6 months. That's a part of the conversation that we could easily neglect here tonight is there's a sort of built-in assumption. We need a new cell phone. We need another can of paint. We need a new mattress. Is part of the disease that we have is not even stopping to think whether we needed to buy that particular thing on that particular day? You're my philosopher. I'm counting on you for that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Yeah, I think the definitive word and the important word right there is need. Mm-hmm. And when you think about what our values are, often what we're valuing is actually not in tune or in line with our, you know, inborn values, which is our inborn values are very, very simple ones, which is that we want to take care of ourselves, we want to take care of the people around us. We don't want to hurt anything or anyone. You know, as a chef, you know, I think about food. You know, you see food as something, and this is inborn. This is stuff that you know right from the beginning. Food is to nourish people, yourself and the people around you. But so much of our behavior is about consuming in a way that has to do with prestige, for instance. I want that cell phone because you've got that cell phone, and oh my God, you have the iPhone 5. The photos on it are incredible, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then it becomes endless, and then the next thing you know, you're living this life which is completely out of tune with who you are as a natural human being. I don't know if I answered it.
No, you're my. You are, that you answered it. You are my philosopher. I'm telling you, you have dinner with him. You will never live the same way. So I'm going to switch gears here for a second because in some ways we were very lucky as we were getting ready for this panel. The Barilla Pasta Company helped us out a little bit. So for those of you who didn't follow this, Guido Barilla, who is the president, CEO, founder, owner of Barilla Pasta, is in Italy. And they're in the middle of a huge conversation nationally in Italy about marketing in Italy. And in fact, about the fact that advertising in Italy, not just for Barilla, but for lots of products, tends to depict families in a very, very traditional way. Not just as heterosexual nuclear families, but heterosexual nuclear families where the husband and the kids are sitting at the table waiting for the mom to bring them something to eat. And so in the midst of this debate, and it's a debate that's going on in Parliament in Italy because they can theoretically regulate speech a little bit more than we can. But anyway, Guido Barilla jumped in and he said that he would never use a gay couple in his advertising. He graciously said that gay people were welcome to continue buying his pasta, but that he wouldn't use them in advertising. He really didn't consider that to be anything close to what he thought of as a traditional family. And went on at some length about this, too. So let's imagine that all of us sitting here don't share his views and are troubled by them. We don't like his tone. Well, we can quietly not buy Barilla Pasta. We can loudly boycott Barilla Pasta. We can somehow or other try to actively engage the Barilla company to see if we can change its attitudes, its tone, its policies. Possibly with David's assistance, we can make our own pasta from wheat grown on commonly held land. We can do a lot of different things.
The slow food movement.
Yeah, exactly. So those are some of our options. Stephanie, I don't know, what are you going to do the next time you have to buy? You don't eat fish, you got to eat pasta.
Yes.
So which among those options do you think is the most likely based on particularly the kind of work that your company does with actual companies, with governments? What works?
Sure. Well, I don't know if there's a recipe, no pun intended, there to figure out what works, but I think that a big part of it is that the companies need to see themselves, that the consumers and not just, you know, the regulators or the policymakers are really demanding these changes. And so there are ways that can happen. You know, I've seen really effective online petitions, change.org, for example, can really make some companies, you know, get their attention pretty fast on things like this or, you know, other things. I think another way, too, is to figure out, you know, what are perhaps Barilla's competitors that are doing the right thing, or are they doing the right thing, you know, a step in front of, you know, at least a little bit better than what Barilla is currently doing, and try to use that somehow as leverage. I think also an interesting aspect that we've come across at the Product Stewardship Institute is we work with an organization based out in California that does shareholder resolutions. And so the companies, or, you know, the shareholders, they get together. And, for example, they've been doing a lot of work having General Mills or other companies reconsider their packaging decisions, not only to reduce the amount of packaging that they're using in a lot of these everyday consumer products, but also to step up and take responsibility for recycling them. And so far, out of all the kind of brand owner consumer packaged goods companies that you'll see in the grocery store, Nestle Waters, which is based in Stanford, actually, has stepped out and said, you know, we really think that as a company, we should be responsible for the recycling of particularly plastic water bottles. They know that, you know, there's some dispute whether or not they should even be used, but they are taking one step in the right direction to take ownership of that. And right now they're trying to get other companies on board. And it's really, honestly, an uphill battle. But I think that there's many different ways that you can kind of get the company's attention, and having consumer activism in there certainly, I think, been proven a proven strategy.
But Barry, she described a couple of different models there. There's one where you kick a company's ass, you know, through online petitions or whatever it takes to get their attention. But she also described with General Mills more of an engagement model, more of a model of working with the company.
Right.
Is there a difference in how companies respond over the long term? Which one do you think is going to work better?
So I believe in both, in the sense of there's a boycott and there's the flip of that, a
boycott.
And it seems to me that you should, there's no reason for you to buy Barilla Pasta if you have an enlightened view of gay marriage, of gay rights. There's plenty of other pastas out there. Mm. And so why would you want to support a company and give the profits to somebody who has offensive views? On the other hand, it seems to me what consumers could do more of is commit to buy things from companies that do the right thing. Because if a company knew that, for example, providing health benefits to partners of any orientation would get them increased market share, they're going to be jumping on board to this. That is, it doesn't take very much. They're spending huge amounts of money on advertising to get people to come to their firm. If they only knew that this would bring them an extra 1 point market share. Now, I'll use the example of what I'll call the kosher effect. Very few customers care about kosher when it comes down to it. And yet, it turns out that Coca-Cola, you know, has little circle U or circle K on all of its products. Why is that? Well, because there's a group of people who say, if it has that, I'm going to buy it. And therefore, if you, so 100% in some sense of the products end up being that way. And if you can get a dedicated group of customers to say, we will buy this if you do that, you will change what companies do.
I mean, Bun, it seems to me in some ways, you know, you probably buy some pasta now and then.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
But, you know, it's whatever the company is, they're doing something that you don't like. They're doing something that you don't agree with. Well, one thing you can do is stop buying their product. But then you still got a company that it hasn't necessarily changed. It's still doing the thing. Maybe by dint of the boycott, you'll get their attention. But at best, you might get their grudging attention. I mean, you sort of do wonder. I mean, I got more excited when Stephanie was talking about really talking to a company like General Mills and seeing if you could really kind of get them to understand why you want and to buy into it as opposed to being whipped into submission.
Well, there's a couple things. I do have the answer to, like, how to deal with the CEO of this company, yeah. Which is that I don't know if you'd agree with me, because we have, like, different approaches in business. You're successful and I'm not, Barry. So, what I would do is I would introduce him to some of my sexiest gay friends, and then so that he would experience the joys of gay sex. And next thing you know, not only would be
see that's not scalable.
Maybe it is.
You're listening to a conversation about ethical consumerism recorded earlier this month. We'll be back after this. We are talking about the idea of ethical consumerism on today's show. Our guests are Barry Nailbuff, Bun Lai, David Bullier, and Stephanie Winnuck. More information about all their projects at WNPR.org. This conversation was taped earlier in the month at Watkinson School in Hartford.
I think all of you travel a good deal, go to other countries, give speeches in other countries. To whatever extent we're having a conversation right here about how everybody in this room can affect the marketplace by making some of the kinds of decisions that we're talking about here, making a decision to buy something that has a better plan for disposability, buying something that's organic, buying something that isn't farmed in some inhumane or destructive way, buying something that's made under good working conditions or at least better working conditions. To the extent that all the people in the room want to do that and are here and ready to talk about it, is this, I don't know, do you see, I'm not even asking a specific person, whoever wants to grab this one. Is this a conversation that goes on in Europe, for example?
Europe is basically, GMO is stopped there.
Right.
And it didn't happen because companies said, I think GMO is bad. It happened because consumers said, we're not going to buy it if it's GMO. And companies responded.
No, well, the companies are still fighting it in terms of the policy level.
I got it, but right now they're responding and not providing that you get non-GMO food there.
They would like to be able to provide it.
It's interesting. In our work, we find that the same, multinational company, for example, Canada and Europe, there are, for packaging, we were talking about that before, there are laws already, sometimes up to 20-plus years. In Germany, for example, that manufacturers of packaging, your water bottles, your tin cans, your cereal boxes, all of that has all been covered under, manufacturers pay into a system that covers the recycling of those products. That's been happening for up to 20 years in Germany, more recently in Canada, but in various places. But these are multinational companies that operate under different rules and different laws in different countries, and U.S., I think, in that respect, is definitely trailing behind some of our Canadian, European counterparts. And it's just interesting because, at PSI, we talk about, did they talk to each other? Did the Canadian and U.S. counterparts get together? And because one has kind of bought in. This is the way. It's producer responsibility is what's happening. We're not fighting it anymore. And the U.S., it's still really a debate and a lot of backlash, I think, from those same companies that are, already operating under a system that's working in those places.
But do people in other countries want to know? I think I was trying to find you one day, and somebody at the restaurant said he's giving a speech in Iceland or Finland or someplace. Do people want to know about what it is that you're doing? Does your message translate well in other countries, or have they already figured this stuff out? Or?
We just did a television show for Japan, which is actually interesting for Japan's largest television station, and we filmed it out of my house, and it was really the idea of eating insects. Three quarters of the world eats insects. Meanwhile, since one of our strongest prejudices is the food, because we have a visceral reaction. We don't want to eat it in this country, and that's the conversation. And the bigger conversation is why we choose to eat what we choose to eat, or why we purchase what we purchase. In Japan, I can tell you that here's a society that is based on Hinduism, and Hinduism is based on the idea that. There's a spirit that exists in all living and non-living things in nature. So the Japanese, if you talk to my mom, she can go on and on about how we're so incredibly connected to nature. Meanwhile, Japan is one of the biggest consumers in the entire world. And as far as being a mindful consumer, is definitely not that.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States, it seems like... we're becoming much more mindful, and I think it really starts. It's not something that's going to change overnight. I think the cultural shifts that allow future generations to make better decisions happen in places like this, where an education is based on philosophical and ethical and moral considerations. So I don't even know what I'm talking
great.
About.
Great, you said it. It was a great answer. Does everybody here, it just came up three times, so does everybody here think GMOs are intrinsically bad? I mean, I ask this because, well, everybody here thinks that.
I do not. I think that you should label products, whether they're GMO or not. So I think people should have a right to know what they're eating, but there are some types of GMO foods that are appropriate.
I mean, even Michael Pollan, I think, is softening his attitudes about this. And obviously there are projects like the Golden Rice Project where they're trying to breed a GMO rice that is richer in vitamin A for areas of the world that are deprived of beta-carotene. We did a panel at the end of the last year on the future where Jay Hughes, one of the futurists, was sitting here saying, you know, as climate change, obviously this is sort of taking one form of questionable or objected to science to deal with another scientific problem. But he says as climate change really, you know, begins to challenge farmers, GMOs may be part of the salvation. You know, we might be able to find things that we could grow in land that isn't arable the way that it used to be. David, I think you have a better answer.
Let me just start with a story. 2 billion people in the world depend upon subsistence commons, forestry, fishery, wild game, water, and the rest for their everyday subsistence. Mm-hmm. Yet introductory textbooks don't even mention this because it's not considered a germane or relevant way of meeting needs. And I might add, subsistence is not bare survival. It's household needs as opposed to market exchange. But I think that the more stable, sustainable, long-term answer will be having crops that are cultivated for particular regions of the world and therefore are native and more responsive to the climate and the soil and the social practices of that community, as opposed to carpet bombing them with some supposedly superior genetically modified crop from somewhere else that happens to need pesticides and herbicides, and oh, by the way, it's transported across the world, et cetera. I think we need to go local. We need to get more integrated with a local ecosystem to be truly sustainable.
We're going to go to question and answer here pretty soon. We'll have some mics floating around here for you to take, so get your questions ready. Before we do that, I got a couple of other areas I wanted to get into really quickly. One of them is, and Barry, you and I have talked about this, but there are some companies that have really bad reputations, and probably Walmart is among the worst reputations. And they got a bad reputation about how they treat their workers. They had a bad reputation about their environmental record. They had a bad reputation even about sort of coming into towns and kind of destroying the local small commerce culture there, driving out the little hardware store. On the other hand, I know Walmart has made some strides, has tried to do better. So, you know, from your point of view, both as a professor of management and as a guy who started kind of a famously ethical company, how do we look at that? A lot of people in this room are never going to walk into a Walmart. You know, they have bad feelings about it. So where's the incentive for Walmart to improve if, in fact, they can't ever get any traction?
Well, I think Walmart has done some unbelievably positive things. They have done more to bring natural light into their stores and thereby reduce the use of electricity. They've done more to get rid of open-air coolers so that their refrigerated units use less electricity than anybody else. So they
like those open-air coolers at Whole Foods?
Like the open-air coolers at Whole Foods, exactly. So they have figured out smarter ways to light their stores, to use electricity than anybody else, and those ideas end up being copied. They have made organic food much less expensive than any other place out there. And that my view is it's nice when we had Edge of the Woods is sort of a New Haven, but if that's the only person who's out there selling organic food, then you're not going to have many organic farmers. You're not going to have organic ingredients. By the time Walmart democratizes organics, that's how it becomes a mainstream movement. And so you don't have to shop there, but there are a huge number of people who are going to, and I applaud them for the truly impressive steps they've taken in terms of bringing organics into the mainstream.
So, David, one of the arguments that Barry is offering, too, is there are some people out there who have $2 to spend on apples instead of $6 to spend on apples. And that if you can get Walmart to stock organic apples, there's a chance that the person with less income to spend can get an apple that we'd all feel a little bit better about. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, I think there's nothing wrong with large companies scaling some of these innovations. I just wouldn't call them pioneers, especially when they're on the rebound of a bad PR bout. But second of all, I think some of these things, to the extent that large enterprises like Walmart can wipe out the local ecosystems of businesses, as we've seen, I think there's value in having locally and regionally sourced material. Now, if a lot of that organic is coming from California or New Zealand, maybe not, but we don't know necessarily. I mean, I know that Whole Foods is trying to do local sourcing. I once asked them what they meant by that. They said, oh, 450 miles. So stuff from Maine was local. You know, so that's the other factor we haven't talked about here is how there's a lot of play in marketing, cause-oriented marketing. Some of it is very sincere and rigorous, some of it less so. And God help us poor consumers in trying to sort through it all. When there are competing indices of what's more sustainable, right. Itself a very abused term.
Yeah. So, yeah, we haven't used the term greenwashing, but I mean, there seems to be a green version of everything, right? There's a green variant of Lysol or something. It just seems unlikely to me somehow. Well, Barry, you know, in marketing honest tea, and the book, Mission in a Bottle, you can just go cartoon frame by cartoon frame, all the decisions that you guys made that were, you know, in each case, you know, driven by you and also by your partner, who really felt like this company had to live its principles all the time. First of all, did you find yourself competing with other brands that were making comparable claims that you didn't really think sort of lived it to the same limits that you did?
So two responses. Mm. One, that's ultimately why we decided we had to be organic. Because all natural doesn't mean anything. You can have GMO ingredients there. You can have products like high fructose corn syrup, which nowhere exist in nature, that are part of all natural. Mm-hmm. So and there have been lawsuits over the various ingredients that go in that. So you want having somebody come in and impose standards, I think, is incredibly helpful. The other is that one of the things we struggled with was we have a juice pouch. And it turns out these juice pouches are not recyclable because they have a foil inside. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, they're terrific because unlike bottles or plastic, it's 99% juice and 1% packaging. So it uses very little packaging. Mm-hmm. So how do you get the best of both worlds? Well, we partnered with TerraCycle. And we had school collection places where kids would send hundreds of these things back to turn them into backpacks, to pencil cases and the like. And in fact, they're all sold out. but we were small. Kraft then copies us, goes to TerraCycle as well, and does now hundreds of millions of these things. And our view is if our influence ends up being that we change the way other companies do it, okay, mm-hmm. that's all right. We can show that it's possible, that there's demand for this. And so I'm all right with showing that customers will, in fact, go that extra step.
That was Barry Nailbuff, co-founder of Honest Tea. You're listening to a conversation about ethical consumerism recorded at the Watkinson School. We'll be back.
Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill and Betsy Kaplan, who were not fed antibiotics or hormones, and by me. I'm Wildcaught. Thanks to our friends at Event Resources, who helped on the scene at Watkinson. The part of Bill Curry was played by Alicia Silverstone. On tomorrow's show, Talking Baseball with Steve Rushen. And now, back to Colin.
Okay, I think we can open it up to questions here. I've got Betsy's up there. Do you have a mic now, or we're just going to use those mics?
Just a couple points of information on the smartphones. There are two models that are being developed in Europe right now that are vastly more sustainable. Of course, you know, nothing's perfect, the golden egg. One is called the Fairphone, which is completely transparent in its sourcing. And the other is... I'm going to forget the name. It's like block phone. It's phone block, thank you. It's modular so that rather than planned obsolescence, like we were talking about earlier, you can just add in the components. It's fabulous. Another point on poverty and intelligence, there's been a lot of press on that, on how poverty and the stress of it actually decreases your IQ. I encourage everybody to look at that when you're thinking about why are poor people eating at McDonald's.
Sendil Mendelathan.
Yes, yeah. So a question that I have, relating again to the poverty question, maybe if each of you could just give like one talking point on how do we engage people who are not already, you know, we're preaching to the choir here. So how do we engage, you know, my conservative uncle or my Spanish-speaking neighbors or, you know, people that are not on board already?
So one solution is that Walmart is where they are. And if you have a chance to meet them there and the prices are inexpensive, that is one way to introduce them to this. I think, you know, we used to teach home economics. And the fact is that cooking for yourself is less expensive than buying prepared foods, than eating out. And if you understand how to do it simply and quickly, my latest solution, I can't tell you how much chia pudding I've been eating. And it's unbelievably easy, I think remarkably healthy and quick. I discovered now I can make it for a week or 2 weeks at a time.
And chia, but it's like chia. Are you eating chia pets? Is that what you're
exactly? Basically,
you kind monster.
I'm a monster. It's I don't know, but it doesn't grow hair. It's lonely.
All right. Who else got a question here? I think Jenny, it's yeah, one of your people, maybe.
Thank you very much. I'd like to move back just a little bit to the issue that was raised about your tea company being part of another company now. There's a debate that's really raging within the non-GMO and organic community about whether or not we have a responsibility to buy or not buy from companies whose parent companies are not falling in line with what we want in our food. I'm not sure that you can give me particular figures, but I'm wondering if I go out and buy your product, is all of the money that I'm spending on your product going back to the parent company and being put back into the organic part of their business? Or when I buy your product, is any part of my money going to the parent company to put into products and projects which I don't want to have anything to do with?
Good question.
And I'm sorry if I put you on the spot.
But it's hard to say, really, to say the answer to that question. Because right now, the money is all going back into Honest Tea to support future growth. But ultimately, that money is going to go to the shareholders of Coca-Cola. So my view on this is that the publicity that's created, the boycotts that are created, that gets attention. There's no question about it, and that helps move people's views. At the same time, it's also the case that the people inside Honest Tea are lobbying the same way you want them to lobby. And so if they're not succeeding as a company and they don't make more sales, then your voice doesn't get heard. And so the question is, do you want to reward your advocates or hamper them? And their voice gets heard more the more sales they make, because that's ultimately what's going to happen inside Coca-Cola. If they have $1 billion of sales, they will always win. And if they have $100 million of sales, they can be ignored. And that so your question is, how do you help them get there while also achieving your goals?
The main thing I want to do right now is, this has been such a great panel. Give them a huge round of applause. They're amazing. You guys are great.
I'm Kyone Wolf. I think there's something seriously wrong with this onion. It's making me tear up. What kind of crazy manufactured genetic beast is this? Ugh, and my tears, they're clear. What is going on?